Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to violence.
Welcome to Lost in the Static.
And welcome to Lost in the Static indeed. Now, I'm going to be flying solo with this one. Scott was unavailable. Let's get the Adam and Eve promo out of the way, but I do have a special guest that I'll introduce in a moment. If you go to adamandeve.com, use the promo code STATIC, you get 50% off of a single item, you get 3 free DVDs, you get a free mystery gift, and Adam and Eve will even cover your shipping in the United States, all for using the promo code STATIC. You can't lose using the promo code STATIC. Now, like I said, Scott's unavailable. He's on assignment. But with me is my special guest, Scott Murray.
Hey, hello, Josh. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to be here, Scott Murray.
Oh, that's absolutely no problem. It's been fun. I've been listening to you guys. It almost seems like since episode one, really, but I'm not quite sure when. But it's been a good time.
Well, okay, I've been listening to another pagan podcast, and all of you out there should be as well. And you've got some other show that I can't, the name's escaping me at the moment. But I wanted to talk to you about you. I wanted to talk about your history, how you got into this, things of that nature. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's perfectly fine. I'm happy to be on here. Of course, you know, there is a lot of work that goes into another pagan podcast. I do that show with my wife and our friend Teresa. And my wife, Dawn, does, to be honest, the majority of the work for that show. But I try and keep them on track, and we have a good time doing it. And I hope we're doing something positive for the pagan community.
What kind of listenership do you have?
It's not huge. There's only a couple of hundred. But on the Facebook page, at least they're active. We get a lot of comments. We get a lot of feedback on our episodes that we do. We can, you know, if we post an article or something up there, it's a small group, but it's a vocal group, and I'm happy to have them on board.
All right. Now, the other show you do, does that get any kind of decent numbers, or what's all involved in
now,
that?
I don't even really want to talk about it. The co-host and I, we've had our problems, and we've actually had fights on the air. And, you know, God forbid one of us wants to listen to music when the other one's around, because it's just, to tell you the truth, it's going downhill quickly, and I don't even really want to talk about that one.
All right. Well, let's talk about your history a little bit. How did you get into doing these shows? Or actually, let me go back even farther.
Sure.
Let's talk a little bit about you. Tell the audience who might not be familiar with Scott Murray from another pagan podcast
Okay. A
little bit about you and your history.
Well, it's no problem. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. Had a very, very lucky childhood. Went to public school, moved up to a place called Muncie, Indiana, which is where I spent most of my childhood. Went to a kind of combination of public school and homeschooling.
You've talked about some of that on the show, haven't you?
Yeah, a little bit. My mother had one of those weird professions. By the time I came around, she retired from being a school teacher. And she then got into the professional hot air ballooning circuit. And she first got her license when I was about 3 or 4 years old, and then really started flying and got her commercial license by the time I was about 6.
I'm just picturing them racing NASCAR style, having to make big banking turns and hot air balloons. Or am I totally misinterpreting what you're talking about? Your mom did.
You have totally you know, I say race hot air balloons, and they go, how do they steer them? They don't. Put necks out in a field and tell the pilots, all right, we send up little things called pie balls or pilot balloons. They're little helium balloons, and you release them, and you track them as they go through the atmosphere. And wind is built like layers of a cake. So at 1,000 feet, it might be going north. But at 1,500 feet, it's going north, northeast. And then maybe at 2,000, 3,000 feet, it's going east. You know, it's weird that way. So what you do is you track this little black helium balloon as it goes up through those layers, and you figure out which way it's going. So you've got this X out in the middle of the field, and they say you have to take off at least 5 miles from the X. And then so you go and you find a field where you think the winds are going to take you back to the X, and you take off and you get a little, it's kind of, have you ever played those, like that tic-tac-toss game?
Not familiar with that. Okay. No.
It's a little beanbag is what you
get. Oh, that. Then, okay. I didn't recognize the name, but yes.
Yeah. You toss the beanbag into the, well, you get one of those, a little beanbag, and it's got a little 6-foot tail on it and your number and everything like that. And then as you go over the center of the X, you toss the baggie.
And whoever's closest?
He who gets closest to the center of the X wins the competition that day. And that's the basic rules. You can imagine all of the variations that come.
I'm picturing ESPN was not breaking down the door to
cover this. ESPN was
huh?
not breaking down the door. Actually, you'd be surprised. Everywhere we went, we got coverage. But it was usually, ooh, look at the pretty balloons.
Oh, so like local news, fluff stories?
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, we would do things to please the crowds at the airfields, like mass ascensions where we all take off from the airfield and then you deal with whatever
comes your way.
Whatever, you know, whatever task was set forth by the actual person in charge of the competition. The competition, although it was big to us, certainly didn't. It didn't win any media awards for that one. But
well, you said your mom was a champion. She won some of these.
We won quite a few. I mean, you know, we won enough to keep going.
You keep saying we. You were involved?
Yes. I since about the age of 8 or 10, I was her official ground crew chief, which means that I was in charge of the balloon as long as it was on the ground. I was in charge.
You were a guard.
What?
A guard.
No.
Guard my shit.
No. Oh, because okay. Before you get the balloon in the air, you have to lay it out. And you have there was a crew of usually about five or six, anywhere up to 10 of
us. You were
us.
A pit crew.
Yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, and you help inflate the balloon, and then the balloon goes, and your chase, you have to get in the van with the trailer and chase the balloon because it's not coming back, you know. And when it hits the ground, when it lands, if a pilot is concentrating too much on what's going on with the actual envelope or the balloon part of the balloon, then he or she or they in some cases can get hurt on the ground. So your ground crew is there to kind of catch you and make that landing a little bit easier.
Navigator.
No, not really. The pilot was in charge of navigation. But on the ground, yeah. You obviously had to figure out how, you know, what roads to take to get to where the balloon
was. It's not going to be a straight shot. You're not going to be driving on the field.
Well, you might be, but you have to, you know, and before the balloon lands, if they land at a farm, you have to get landowner permission. So usually the farmers were up because of atmospheric conditions and stuff like that, you fly really early in the morning or later into the evening just prior to sunset. And so usually the farmers were up by the time we got there. And there were a couple of times when I got greeted by a shotgun. You know, y'all ain't coming on my property and tell that big scary thing from God to leave. You know, so you had to deal with that. Often if you landed, like when we flew in the city, there was a couple of times when the only place we could find to land, I forget what city this was, but it was a pretty big one. The only place we could find to land was this vacant lot between skyscrapers.
And man, I'm just picturing so pre-9/11. Huh?
Oh, it was bump, ha! But when it came down, it happened that we were landed in some housing projects, and so all of these kids. And, you know, anybody from kids to gangbangers to, you know, really pretty scary individuals start pouring out of these buildings to come see the balloon. And I got to admit, they were the nicest people in the world. And, you know, if you keep it tethered to the ground, we did a couple of up and down runs just right there, giving some of these kids a flight.
A little ride.
Yeah, a little ride, you know, something that they're never going to see. But I thought it was hilarious that most of the time... It was the genteel farmer, the man of the land, that would greet us with a shotgun. But if you happened to land in a city or fly over a city, it was the big, scary, you know, gangbanging
check
black
yourself,
guys.
Fool.
Yeah, you know, that you're pretty darn sure just finished doing a drive-by. They'd be like, you with that balloon? Yep. Oh, that is awesome, man. And they
hey,
were
who
they
doesn't
were really
like a
nice,
balloon?
You know,
everybody likes a balloon.
Most of the time. But yeah, we did this around the world. We flew, she's still flying. I don't get to quite as much because she's in Florida and I'm in Wisconsin. But we've flown all across the U.S. In various competitions, from Indianola, Iowa, to haven't flown in Alaska yet. I want to do that someday because, my God, big, beautiful land up there that I'd love to see. See here, competitions in Mexico, Canada, most of Europe, Japan.
Just hope you don't
Vietnam.
Land on that horrible Jules Verne's mysterious island. They got there with a hot air balloon.
That's true. The closest that we came, and this wasn't us, but we were at a competition in Saga, Japan, and one of their oil companies there, I don't remember exactly which one, but one of its logos is a big blue whale. So there was this hot air balloon shaped like a giant blue whale, not a realistic one, a very cartoony one. But it took off, and he couldn't find a place to land, and he couldn't find a place to land, and he couldn't find the place to land. And then he reached the coast of Japan, and there wasn't any place to land, and he got out over the ocean. And generally, wind goes in one direction.
Especially
on
the ocean.
One general direction. And so you get out past that coastline and over the ocean, and there's nothing to do. But he found there was an oil tanker.
I was about to say a trawler he could land on or something?
Well, he found an oil tanker out there, and he didn't land on the oil tanker, but he landed next to it. So the next day in the Saga Prefecture newspaper, I couldn't read the article or anything, but there's this big, giant front-page photo of a big cartoony blue whale in the ocean right next to this oil tanker that carried the same logo on the oil tanker.
Would have been funny if it was a white whale. I get the white whale. Say you get the joke, at least.
Exactly. Ahab gets his revenge.
Well, and then something that you've mentioned a couple of times in that last statement was traveling all over the world. I've
yes.
heard you mention that on the shows
yes.
before. You want to tell us a little bit about your travels and things that you've done and accomplished?
Again, it was a very, very lucky childhood. And mainly when I traveled, it would sort of, you know, you would go for a competition and then end up staying for a few weeks after the competition just to take in, you know, I mean,
you're in Japan, you're not going to waste it.
Yeah, you can go to the best school in the United States. And I believe that it would never, ever replace the experience and the teaching ability of actually being there. For instance, like I said, we've been over Europe. And during that particular competition run of going through Europe, anywhere from England to Liechtenstein to... well, at the time it was the Soviet Union.
I was just about to ask, can you narrow it down a little bit to what era you were going over Europe?
When I first got to Europe, the first time I went to Europe, I had to be 12-ish. And then I've been back multiple times since.
So are we talking the early 80s here then?
Mid-80s. Mid-80s for the first time, and then the last time I was in Europe was when I was over there for school in the mid-90s. So about that 10-year stint, I did, I think, 4 or 5 trips through various parts of Europe.
I bet a lot of our listeners wish they could have had an experience like that at that time in their lives.
It's a shame, really, because I look back now, and at the time... You know, I'm 10, 11, 12 years old, and I'm having a good time, you know, and I'm checking out, and, you know, I see Big Ben, and, yeah, I've seen pictures of that, or you know, you go and you see the Arc de Triomphe or the Eiffel Tower, and you're like, okay, you know, this is neat.
not nearly as interesting in person.
Not nearly as interesting in person, especially to a 10-year-old, because part of me was like, when are they going to hold a competition at Disney World?
You know? I'd rather be watching the Transformers right now.
I was never really a TV kid. That's actually when you know, you and I talked before the show, and you have this amazing knowledge of 80s television and stuff like that that I just don't have because I wasn't here.
But you were doing things that, as I said, a lot of people probably wish they could have done. Traveling through Europe and Japan and whatnot, especially at that arguably turbulent time in history.
Yeah, Japan was in 1989. And then immediately after Japan, we went actually back to Europe. We had a competition in Germany, and that's what put me in Germany in November of 1990.
Well, then, okay, you've done all that, and I'm going to ask you about your TV work and things like that.
Sure.
But what made you move to the butthole of Wisconsin?
A woman. What else would make it?
Of course, huh?
What else would hold that kind of a power over a man but a woman? I guess unless you're homosexual, then it would be another man. But anyway, after all this traveling had kind of stopped, and it all kind of stopped after I finished high school, and my parents decided it was time for me to get serious about my education. That's when I started college. And I started college at the University of Evansville in southern Indiana, and spent 1 year there, jumped over to England for 2 years, came back. And
you jumped over to college in England?
I jumped over to college. The University of Evansville has basically an extended English campus called Harlaxton College, right by Grantham in Lincolnshire. And you go to school in this old English manor house, this, you know, four story, basically it's the size of a good, you know, a good sized hotel.
And you see an 80s sitcom building here.
Yeah, but you live in the English manor house, and you go to school in the English manor house, and there are gardens and tourists coming through every day and interesting things like that. And then, you know, the driveway was a mile long. So you would walk to the end of the driveway, and luckily right across the street from the manor house was a little pub called the Gregory Arms. And that's where I would go and spend time in the pub. And then it was another 3 mile walk into town at Grantham. But yeah, that was, so a lot of walking. I was in better shape back then.
Something I've always been curious about, maybe you can answer this, Doug.
Sure.
Over when, you know, in Australia or England or places where they drive on the wrong side, as we call it.
Right.
That's got to be disorienting for an American at first. Is it?
You would, yes. I went to Australia in 1980. End of 79, beginning of 80, we spent time down there basically the winter of that year. Because I've got family in Melbourne. And so we went to Melbourne, and you're in Australia, so no use staying in Melbourne. We went to Sydney and Perth and Adelaide, and we've got other friends in New Zealand, other hot air balloon pilots that we were down there. We were going to go visit them. and I remember that was one of the rare trips that my dad joined my mom and my sister and I on. And Dad did all of the driving because we drove around the country.
Still must have been disorienting for a kid to be on the wrong side of the car, on the wrong side of the road.
It was very disorienting for me. Where it really came to head was when I went to college in England. Because we had a few professors that, there was one professor that found out it was cheaper to go to England and buy a car while you're there rather than renting it for 4 months. So he bought a car, and there was a couple of times when he would take us out, and he looks at me, and you know, I walk out of the college to the car, and I open up, and I'm like, oh, this is the driver's side. I was going to sit on the passenger side. And it was not uncommon for even even after being there for 6 months, we would still walk out to the car and you would just automatically walk. You know, he thinks I'm driving. And so he goes to what he thinks is the driver's side of the car. And suddenly I'm on the driver's side and he goes, oh, well, you're there. And he throws me the keys. And it was more than once during my little, now I never drove in the big cities. I never drove in London. I never drove in, you know, even, I think the biggest city I drove in was Grantham, but I did drive out to this little town called Pickworth, or Pitworth as they say. And yeah, I'd be driving along the road and meep as this truck comes in. I'm like, oh girl, yeah, other side.
You think you're in the right lane.
Exactly. Because there's no other cars around and you're just going down the road like you have been your entire life. And oh yeah. I think the worst was getting on to roundabouts. Now here in Wisconsin we have plenty of roundabouts. But you drive up to a roundabout, which way do you go?
Yeah, I'm picturing National Lampoon's European Vacation.
Yeah, you know, on a roundabout here, it's an automatic thing that you drive up to it and you go to the right and around the roundabout that way. Well, in England, you drive up and you go to the left. And most roundabouts, you know, you're thinking, okay, if this were an intersection, I want to make a right turn, I'll just take the first exit on the roundabout. Well, over there, you're like, I have no idea which way I'm going. So yeah, that was disorienting as all get out. And it's something that I'm sure, had I been there for longer, I would have eventually gotten used to it. In fact, when I came back, it was a little disorienting to get back on the right side of the road.
The correct side of the road.
Well, it's literally Americans. The right side of the road.
I know, so. But I didn't know if you meant right as right or right as right.
Yeah, same thing.
Well, so you spent all that time in England and whatnot, and you said a woman brought you back to Wisconsin. Now
the woman didn't bring me back to Wisconsin. I finished 2 years of school out there, and it was time for me to come home, and that's all there was to it. I'd spent as much time as I could at Harlaxton, because you can't go to the University of Evansville and then graduate from Harlaxton. You have a limited amount of times you can go. So I went for the maximum amount of time, came back, and finished my degree. Well, attempted to finish my degree at the University of Evansville, and for various reasons I need not go into, I didn't get my degree. But I ended up staying in Evansville, a nice little town. And during that time, right out of college, I ended up working for a Fox station in Evansville. And then from the Fox station, I got a job doing microwave radio installs. So I would climb
towers. How long did you work at the Fox station?
Just a few months. It was basically an internship it was a 6 month internship. And then I think I worked there for another 6 months.
So a year?
Yeah. And that didn't work out too well. I didn't enjoy that. It was not a good station to work for.
Well, I've heard the stories of one of your later. Was it better than the later station that you worked for?
Well, like I said, after the Fox station, I got a job doing microwave radio installs. So I got to go around the country climbing towers and doing work on that side of broadcast. And then when the internet bubble popped, and the work for microwave radio kind of dried up, I ended up going back to television, and that was when I worked for the ABC station in Evansville and worked there for a couple of years or so.
Was it a better experience on the Fox station?
Much, much, much better experience. Higher rated stations, so people weren't quite under so much stress. Good people to work for, good reporters that... You know, reporters and anchors, and it was a rare mix, because we only had one anchor that looked down on crew and kind of looked down on other.
It seems like every station
has
one.
At least one. But yeah, he was kind of up on his pillar, but everybody else, it was truly a team deal. And that was when 2001, I spent September 11th, 2001 there when I was, well, I was working there when that happened. So, and that just kind of brought the station together even more so.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, and it was just an amazing place to work.
Well, and then I've heard on the, you did a special with Brad Westmar, and you mentioned that you used to be a DJ. Can you talk a little bit about your DJ experience? what era did you do that? Was that the 90s?
See, now I've held DJ jobs. They've always kind of been a side job. I don't think I've ever been just a DJ, because between working for the two TV stations, I got a job at Radio Shack. And that's when I had my paying DJ gigs, and I've always kind of had paying work, voiceover work. Got my start in radio while I was in college. Pretty much second year I was there. In England, they had a low power FM one that broadcasts off of the Manor House, and I had a show on that one that was just kind of goofy and fun. And then when I came back, actually one of the highest rated FM stations in Evansville is the college station, WUEV, and I did a show every Sunday there, and that was where I really got my start. And then, like I said, I'm always looking for the little AM station or FM station that'll hire me for voiceover work and stuff like that. I don't think I've ever been just a DJ other than in college.
Well, how did you move from that into doing that other show and Pagan Podcast?
Eventually my travels brought me to meet my wife, Dawn. Friends in Evansville said, "Hey, there's this Pagan Festival that we go to every year, and you're going this year." And I said, "Really? I'll look into it. I'll see if I can." They said, "No, you're going this year."
And you were not a Pagan at this point?
Well, I was, but it was... yeah, I was, but I wasn't really into it. I liked all the other Pagans I've met, so I hung out with them a lot.
A dabbler?
Yeah. And then I eventually, I went with them to PSG, where on pretty much the last day, Dawn walks up to me and goes, "You're cute and I'm drunk. Let's go back to the tent." And
I've heard you tell that story before, yeah.
And we did. And through talking to her and everything like that, it was easier for me to kind of pack up what I had and move up here to Wisconsin, to where I asked her, you know, I came and visited for a weekend and brought a ring with me. And her initial reaction, I think, was, "Oh, shit, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God." But eventually that became yes.
You wore her down?
Yeah. And then I moved up here, and here I've been. Had a group of friends that for whatever reason, I started listening to podcasts about 2004, 2005. And I was listening and I thought, you know, that doesn't sound like that's too difficult to do. And I was talking to my friend Paul and his girlfriend at the time, Caitlin. And I said, you know what? How many times have we had conversations where we say, you know, this should really be recorded? So we started recording it. We did this little show called SaterCast, and did that for 2 years, Paul and Caitlin and me and Dawn. And it was, we did it for as long as it was fun. And when it stopped being fun, we kind of stopped doing the show.
Can you go into any more detail? What do you mean by stop being fun? If you don't want to talk about it,
no, it's okay. I'm just trying to figure out how to word it well. We would record once a week, and we would just do one show once a week and then throw it up online. And what started out as an experiment, one of our first episodes was us doing the Jones Soda Challenge. And it was us and a bunch of other friends. And it was something that when it started, I would look forward to it every week. And, you know, well, this is kind of a crappy Wednesday, but Paul and Caitlin are coming over tonight, and we're going to have fun recording. And when you reach the attitude of, "Oh, my God, it's Wednesday, and I have to listen to Paul and Caitlin and Dawn, and they have to listen to me, and we've got to put this show up, because by that time we did have a decent fan base.
That was going to be my next question, was what kind of fan base.
Again, not huge, but at least a couple of hundred active people. And I, looking at the download stats, and I don't put much faith in them just because of the hosting company. According to the hosting company, we were getting an on average 800 to 900 listeners a week. But about 200 of them were active and would talk to us. And about 10 of those would call into the show on a regular basis and everything like that. But yeah, it eventually just kind of lost its magic, and so we just kind of went away.
Did you even have a final episode, or just sort of just stopped?
No. I mean, if you listen to the last few episodes of Satercast, I think I did a couple where I had some other friends on and interviewed somebody, and I tried to keep that show going as long as I could, but it eventually just ended up being just me, and nobody wants to listen to just me for an hour.
Actually, I think people are going to like this episode, which is mainly you.
I hope so, but
I mean, you speak much more eloquently than my normal co-host. Scott is not nearly as eloquent as
I've heard him. He definitely does need some elocution work. I'm not going to badmouth somebody that's not here to defend themselves.
Well, one last thing about Satercast. Is this something that people can still actively find if they choose to?
I'm sure there's an archive out there somewhere. I don't know where. I'd heard rumors that there was a torrent, but I don't think there are any seeds left in that one.
So you have no plans to put these back up on one of the torrent sites? Is it something you want to put behind you, or you just don't think anyone cares?
It was fun for its time, and I really enjoyed the people that were involved in that show and everything like that. Since then, we've grown apart. And so for me, especially there toward the end when Dawn would be on the show, and you can just audibly hear that she doesn't want to be there. And you could hear that she didn't want to be there, and Caitlin didn't want to be there. And Paul was kind of half-assing it, and I was trying, but you could
like
tell
a
that
true
I
professional.
Was. You could tell that I was. No, you could definitely hear the depression in my voice, and it was a rough time for all of us that we were going through.
So this is not something that's going to pop up on iTunes.
No, it's not. It's very painful for me to listen to, frankly.
Does the memories come back?
Yeah, memories of what people used to be and where I used to be, and during a much happier time, and then. Again, you kind of hear it fall apart, and I don't want to hear it fall apart again.
Oh, that's totally understandable.
So, yeah.
And then you worked at one of the Green Bay stations.
I did.
TV stations.
I did.
Well, two, actually, if I remember correctly.
Two in total, but one for long enough that I think I made an impact, and one that it never got off the ground.
Well, start at the beginning of the Green Bay experiences then.
Okay. Eventually, after finally getting an associate's degree, I was looking around for work and found a production assistant job at WGBA.
For those that might not know, what is a production assistant's job?
Basically. You're a station bitch is the best way that I can explain it. Within the production department, you can do various jobs, anything from running an audio board to working with graphics to running a camera out in the studio, taking care of the studio, making sure that it's all good and clean and ready to go. You're also kind of the link between the control room and the talent. Everything kind of goes through you so that you're a buffer so that the control room doesn't have to listen to the talent complain about stupid things.
And so are you that guy that you always see in the wide shot that's wearing the headset that's standing right next to the camera and
that's
waving
precisely
their hands
it.
Around?
That's precisely it. That's precisely it. And it was a fun job. And I met some really interesting people and had interesting times with a sheep on set, and that was where, well, the show that I don't want to talk about, that's where I met that that co-host, and gosh, at the beginning we were decent friends, but I guess, you know, when the only time you just drifted apart. Well, you know, when the only time that you spend with a person is at work, you don't really see their true colors come out, and maybe he wasn't. I'm sure he wasn't presenting a different person at work than he was outside of work, but eventually, when both of us had our tenure at that station and we started spending a lot more time together, and you know, I might be able to take two or three hours of him at a time, but any more than that, I just want to kill him.
I have friends like that. I'm sure you do. I know what you're talking about. I know the kind of person.
Exactly. And I'm sure somewhere out there, there's somebody that feels exactly the same way about me. You know, oh, thank God I don't have to work with that guy anymore.
Well, now, you mentioned your tenure ending. Can you talk anything about why your tenure ended? Because I could hear some bitterness in your voice that it did not sound like it was your choice.
Well, there's a lot that happened at that station that shouldn't have happened. Shouldn't morally or shouldn't legally? Right.
Okay.
there is a pending legal case where that station is named as a defendant, and me and a few other people, by a few, I mean a good chunk of their employees, are actively involved in a case right now that I don't want to talk about.
Oh, well, that's understandable. But does that affect why you left, how you left?
Yes. Okay. And that's as far as I can go.
Okay. Well, and then what about the other one, the other station in Green Bay you went to?
A good year and a half went, you know, after that experience that I just went, okay, never mind. I'm not supposed to work in TV. I'm never working in TV again, which everybody that works in TV has said at some point in their life, I'm never working in TV again. I found another production assistant job at WFRV, Channel 5 here in Green Bay, and I did my job well enough, and I did what was required of me. I got along with the talent, and I got along with most people, but I never fit.
You were always sort of the odd man out.
I was always the odd man out, and I never was able to relate to anybody there, with the exception of one person that was there kind of toward the end of my tenure, that I unwittingly trained to be my replacement. He and I got along amazingly well.
Did he know you were training him to be? No, he didn't. Because I was going to say then that was kind of a dick move on his part.
No, he didn't know that either. You know, like I said, I did my job well, and everybody that I worked with, you know, he's a hell of a PA. I just never gelled with the team. So when I did lose that job, it was, you know, I just said, is this a reflection of my work abilities? You've just never fit with the team.
So you were let go, even though you did your job properly, because you didn't gel with the team?
It's not uncommon. Believe it or not, it's not uncommon in TV. It's because I've talked to other people that were in the, and yeah, if you don't fit, even if you do your job well enough, if you don't fit, you don't fit.
I would have thought the opposite. I would have thought it would have been about the quality of the work you're putting out.
That's about 80% of it. The other 20% is how you interact with your coworkers, and you know, one thing that directors and production directors, who are the people in charge of the production department, always have going through the back of their mind is, what if shit went down? Excuse me. Can I curse?
Is it okay? On the show, it's okay.
Okay. You know, what if shit went down and we had to spend multiple days together? Would I want to be locked in a newsroom with these people? And if the answer to that question is, well, yeah, all except for this guy, then this guy doesn't fit. And that's just the way it is. It's just the way it is.
So it's the opposite of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, and then after that, what did you do after you left the WFRV station?
tell you the truth, for a long time I sat around on my hands. And like I said, I got together with the co-host of the show that's going downhill right now. And we started that for fun. And then eventually picked up a sponsor, and it's, you know, somewhat keeps the lights on. But
did you get any kind of listenership out of that?
Yeah, we do. I hooked up with this place called Jackalope Radio Station. It's an online radio station. I'm sure you've never heard of it. But it's this little online radio station. We get a decent amount of listenership, and like I said, we did pick up one sponsor, and I think he's working on picking up another one. I know I'm looking at a couple, but
it's just not a happy experience on that show.
Well, he's such a jerk. He's really, really difficult to work with, and I'm not the only one.
You realize
that
he
way.
Might hear you say this. He might listen to this when this airs,
and he would probably agree with me 100%. He'd probably be like, "Yo, well, you're no fucking bowl of cherries. I'm so sorry. I don't like to curse. I don't like to let it out. So yeah, but nonetheless, you know, I'm sure he thinks that life is no bowl of cherries with me either, but." The one thing that I will give him, and I will give him this, is generally, like when we have a guest on the show, what he doesn't bring to the table, I will. And what I don't bring to the table, he will. So we do play off of one another quite nicely.
So professionally you work?
And I think he is a good co-host for the most part. It's just that outside of the station, it's near impossible for us to really even be in the same room together.
High maintenance?
Very. You know, if you want to go out to dinner, with him, you've got your choice of like three restaurants. And if you walk into any one of those three restaurants, the people greet him by name and know exactly what he's going to order. So God forbid you have a new experience. He had an opportunity a while back to work on a film and, you know, hemmed and hawed and couldn't decide whether he wanted to go down. Well, luckily for him, circumstances outside of all of that made it impossible for him to go down. But one of the things that he talked about was, you know, he couldn't even stand to be away from his house and he didn't want to sleep in a hotel or anything like that. And I'm like, you idiot, this is something new. This is a chance to make yourself better. Go. But no.
So is this the kind of relationship you think is sustainable, or well, is the show on the rocks?
No, it's sustainable. I mean, professionally, we get along well enough. And like I said, he does bring a lot to the table that I don't, and vice versa. So yeah, I don't think the show is going to go anywhere. I hope we don't start losing listeners though, you know, which is kind of unnerving because it's chiefly what I do for a living now. I do have a day job of going and taking inventory of large stores and mapping large stores or rearranging stores, basically everything in retail other than selling. But that's,
can you explain a little bit about that for people that might not know that or might not be familiar with that aspect of when they go into a Target or a Walmart, what all had to be done prior to them?
Well, sure. And you can do this next time that you walk in. Walmart's a perfect example. You know, take a look around and understand that every shelf had to be built, every shelf had to be filled, and everything that's there on at least twice a year, everything that's there has to be counted. And if it's got a grocery section, you know, then you're looking at four times a year. And Walmart doesn't have enough employees. There's not enough employees there to serve the customer base they have, let alone to do
the inventory.
The inventorying, you know, to find out everything that's there and for replenishment purposes. And you know, if they want to rearrange part or all of the store, they can't do that with their own employees. They just don't have enough. Or, you know, the employees that they have, even if they had enough, they don't have the experience needed to get it done in the one or two nights that, you might have to do it.
So would you be an outside consultant, kind of?
Kind of, sort of. I work for a company. I'll just tell you. It's called RGIS, and it stands for Retail and Grocery Inventory Services. And they come to RGIS, and they say, this is what we want to do. Either we have this inventory we want you to take, which we're really, really good at, and we have little wearable computers that you can go through and kind of count things without counting things.
Are you one of those guys that I've seen on TV that doesn't even have to look? They just reach to their hip and start pressing buttons, yep. And it's all accurate?
Yep. That's precisely what it is. And especially in a grocery store, we may not even have to touch the product.
You just gauge by eye.
You just look at it, and you know, some of the guys that are much more experienced than I am, it's impossible to go into a store with them, because I've done some jobs on the road, and we'll all go and go to a grocery store and buy lunch for the week or whatever that we're going to be gone, and they'll walk in, they'll just start counting things. You know, they'll look at a shelf and go, oh my God, there's 34 Twinkies there.
It's just something that gets implanted in your brain.
Implanted in your head. And with me, what I do is what's called smart spacing. I walk into the stores. What I chiefly do is walk into the stores, and then I map. There's a team of us that does a very, very detailed map of the entire store. Detailed enough that you can use the computer data that we come up with to actually recreate the store in 3D. And once you have this very detailed map, then you can move product as you want within that 3D environment, or rearrange the stuff you've got and figure out what you want for new. And there's all kinds of stuff you can do with it. But that's what I do. So now I walk into grocery stores I walk into retail stores in general, and I can tell you the name of almost every appliance that's in there and every fixture. I can tell you who makes the fixtures, how big they are, what their circumference or measurements are. And
do you ever walk into some store you don't have a contract with and just kind of walk in and go, man, they are not using their space economically?
Oh, come. Do you want to go to the grocery store with me when we're done with this? And I'll show you exactly what I do, because, yeah, I do it all the time. and there are little things, especially in like mom and pop shops, that it looks kind of nice and it looks kind of neat, but
it's just not space economical.
It's just not right. And you know, I'm like, oh, you could sell so many more of these things if you just display them like this.
Well, okay, I want to move off this real quick, because we're running out of time. I want to talk a little bit about another Pagan podcast. How did you start that one? I guess the bigger question would be, why did you start that one?
Well, I was a practicing pagan from the beginning of high school. The Christian church never really sat right with me. And I'm not saying that Christianity is a bad choice, and I'm not bad-mouthing Christians.
It just wasn't for you.
It just wasn't for me. And so I searched and I searched and I searched, and I eventually found paganism, like real paganism, in college. Again, another woman I met who was pagan, who introduced me to it, and it fit, and it worked really, really well. And it eventually got me my wife, because of a pagan festival that we were at. But really I'd kind of started to fall out of favor with any kind of church or any kind of religion, but I have lots and lots of pagan friends. So I help when I can, and teach when I can and stuff like that. But listening to a lot of there are multiple pagan podcasts out there, and a lot of them were either Paganism 101, which is
kind of dry and academic.
Well, not even that, but very basic. And there's an author named Silver Ravenwolf. Yes, Silver Ravenwolf. And it's that teenage, you know, here's how you do a love spell. What you need is a pink candle and a red candle and a silver candle. You put it here like this, and you move this. And then you take your B thumb and you do this, and it's
feel good.
It's all very feel good, and there's no real spirituality to it. It has to do with spells, and it has to do with what you do to be a pagan.
It sounds almost manipulative.
I don't know if it's manipulative, but it's what you do to be a pagan. You know, dress like this, do this in your rituals, think this way. And I don't know if that's really manipulative, because generally the people that pick up these books already agree with all of this.
Okay.
But it's what you do.
So so you saw that you needed to add a different voice to this?
The other voice that I found out there, aside from that one, is a very exclusionary voice. The voice of, we're better than you because we're pagan, and so we're going to spend an hour making fun of you. And I said, where's the spirituality? And that's why we started another pagan podcast, was just look a little bit deeper. You know, how do you feel if you are pagan? You know, not what do you agree with, what are your political views, but how do you feel and what can you do to be a better pagan, rather than either bashing the Christian church or bashing Islam or bashing other religions. We're going to build up paganism. Rather than teaching you what to do, you know, it's kind of like if you walked into a Christian church and you went, okay, you're all Christian now, and in order to be a Christian, you have to eat this wafer and drink this little bit of grape juice. And that's what a lot of pagan voices out there were. And again, we wanted to go a little bit deeper, a little bit into the spirituality and the philosophy of paganism. And to tell you the truth, now I'm basically an atheist. But my wife is very pagan. Our friend Teresa is very, very pagan. And I tend to agree with a lot of how they feel. And so I'm sticking around with another pagan podcast.
Have you gotten a lot of positive feedback? You said you have a lot of active listeners, but you didn't say whether that was people that are arguing with you or people going, yeah, right on, brother.
There have been, it's generally an older female crowd, but a lot of them are saying right on, are saying right on because they've never heard anyone agree with them.
So you're sort of giving a voice to the previously voiceless in a way?
Yes, in a way. I'm giving a voice to the average run-of-the-mill pagan. A lot of the ones that you see on TV have sparkle hair out to here, and they're wearing their black robes, and they're so goth they shit bats. And that's not what most of paganism
is. The ones that I would think were weird?
Yeah, the ones that we think are weird. the ones that, it doesn't matter what you think, they are freaking weird. But that's cool. They can, if they're cool with that. But the average, you know, the average pagan needed a voice. And our motto has always been, don't be a douche. And
is that the actual motto?
That's the actual motto of the show, is don't be a douche. And that's how do I make myself a better pagan? Don't be a douche. It's our answer to everything. So there we go. I hate to say it, Josh, but I've got to be. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
I think it's been very enlightening, and I think our audience will like this. And as I said, you're far more interesting and eloquent than my normal co-host, Scott, so please take that as a compliment.
Well, like I said, I'm not going to pick on the guy. He's not here to defend himself, so we'll let that go. But no, I really appreciate you having me on the show. Like I said, I've been listening for as long as I can remember.
Well, where can people find you if they choose to?
At anotherpaganpodcast.wordpress.com. Or if you just go into iTunes and you search up Another Pagan Podcast, we're right there. You can email me at smurray75@gmail.com or anotherpaganpodcast@gmail.com. But yeah, and if people get a chance to listen, I'd love to have them listen in. It's been interesting talking to you, my friend.
Do you even want to plug the other show at all?
Like I said, I don't even want to talk about it. I mean, it's kind of in a state of flux, but they've listened to this, so they at least have a good idea of what it would sound like.
Okay. And I want to say you can reach me at lostinthestaticshow@gmail.com and my website, 1201beyond.com. And remember, go to adamandeve.com and use the promo code static. Have a good night.
Hey, Josh.
What?
Have you recorded any show yet?
No. Fuck off.
No, really.
You're not on this week. Fuck off.
No, look, I've got time. I can do it now.
Too late. I've already got it dealt with.
Oh, God, you didn't have another stupid guest on, did you?
You know what? And he was much better than you, so just shut the fuck up. God, it's my... I'm the fucking producer. I decide who's the guest, God damn it.